The culture of ancient Israel can be considered as an honor and shame society, and this provides an interesting lens to re-examine some familiar Bible stories. To learn more, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. Thank you for joining me today, and please bear with me as I am on the tail end of a cold. So it has settled in my throat, and I'll do the best that I can to get through this episode today, but that's why we're delayed a day. But I'll just be a little raspy as we go through this, so please bear with me. The social world of the ancient Israelites was quite a bit different than our world today. And one of the cultural aspects was the emphasis on honor and shame. Ancient Israel functioned in many ways as an honor and shame society, meaning that a person's identity, status, and moral standing were largely determined by how they were perceived within their community. In such a culture, honor was the highest social value, representing public reputation, respect, and the approval of others, while shame was to be avoided because it signified disgrace and loss of standing. Honor and shame were external social pressures used to reinforce the culture's cherished values and norms. Although an inward conscience mattered, there was a lot of external pressure to comply. Someone who exemplified the virtues and desirable behavior valued by the culture was an honorable person, and they were rewarded with praise and other advantages, and their ranking in society was elevated. On the other hand, a person who acted shamefully had a lower status, and if the behavior was bad enough, they could even be shunned. While a wise person conformed to the norms of society, a fool flaunted the rules of society. Honor cultures still exist today. They are very family-oriented, and one's identity and status is essentially determined by the family that one is born into. A person's primary role in the family is to bring honor to it and to avoid bringing any shame. Members of a family then share in the status of the family as a whole, and they all will defend the honor of their family. So there is a corporate dimension to honor and shame, but there is still individuality, and there can be competition among siblings for preeminence within the family. This brings to mind stories such as Jacob and Esau and Joseph and his brothers. Now, I want to caution that there is some scholarly debate as to how much the ancient Israelites operated within the paradigm or framework of an honor and shame society. Each ancient culture differed in the way honor and shame was defined and applied, and so we want to be cautious about forcing biblical events to fit into this paradigm. But we're going to examine a few examples of events in the Bible that do seem to fit this framework of an honor and shame culture. For the first two examples, let me preface by saying that there was a high value placed on virginity. Virgins were a valuable commodity in the Mediterranean culture because they were a guarantee that a child was the future husband's progeny, and his honor depended on it. The males of the household, especially brothers, were expected to do whatever necessary to prevent their sisters from becoming impure. If an unmarried woman had intercourse, then she was stigmatized and marked. She was considered tainted and had few prospects for marriage. She was considered damaged goods, and the stigma could not be removed. If the males in the family failed to protect the virginity of their sisters, they were expected to avenge the disgrace and kill the perpetrators. But even if the perpetrators were killed, the woman would still be marked for life. In 2 Samuel chapter 14, Tamar, the sister of Absalom, was raped by her half-brother Amnon. She pleaded to Amnon, "Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee." Notice that she was appealing to Amnon's sense of honor by saying that no such thing should be done in Israel, and he would be considered a fool by society. And she reminded him that her life would basically be over if he did this. She would have a difficult time marrying and having children, which would deny her the primary means for a woman in ancient Israel to achieve honor and an elevated status. At least if she was given to Amnon by the king, she could have some fulfillment in life by having children. But if he raped her and violated her, she would be tainted for life. After Amnon raped Tamar, it was Absalom's honor that was challenged because Amnon had violated his sister. Honor necessitated that when one's own honor had been challenged or impugned, some sort of retaliatory measure had to be performed, or the one challenged became shamed and dishonored. So Absalom was technically in a state of dishonor or shame until he could reciprocate against Amnon and attain his honor again. And a male shamed must respond to a greater degree and force than the one who impugned his honor, or else become shameful forever. From our perspective, Absalom's plan that he premeditated for 2 years seems extreme and even brutal, but from the perspective of an honor culture, it was kind of predictable. Also, consider the story of Dinah in Genesis 34. She was raped by Shechem. Now, it's interesting that because marriages were arranged, sometimes a young couple who wanted to be together would engage in consensual intercourse prior to marriage in order to force a marriage. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. Otherwise, there would have been some kind of indication that Dinah contributed to bringing shame on her family. But it was Shechem who showed disrespect for the family by violating Dinah, and her family was undeniably shamed by the incident. The response to shaming was usually either verbal or violent, and in the case of costing the virginity of a female family member, it was usually a violent response. Now, interestingly, the Bible says that Shechem was more honorable than all the house of his father. He wanted to make things right by marrying Dinah, but her brother Simeon and Levi decided to avenge their sister because of her loss and the family's loss of honor. This was a natural response, but their revenge went too far. It was deceitful for them to play along and act like they would give their sister in marriage, even going so far as to use the covenantal sign of circumcision as a means to weaken the men of the city. Then they ambushed the men, looted the city, and carried off women and children. Their devastatingly violent response was not in proper proportion to what had been done to their sister. So they, in turn, brought shame onto their family. But they felt no remorse when Jacob rebuked them by saying that they had stirred up trouble and caused the family to be repugnant among the Canaanites, basically a loss of honor. The brothers unapologetically replied, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" So even though some type of response was expected to restore the family's honor, Simeon and Levi engaged in deceit and greed that was out of proportion, and Jacob rebuked them for showing no evidence of shame or remorse. Another interesting aspect of honor cultures was that there was a perspective of limited goods. In other words, the world was considered interconnected, and there was a limited amount of wealth, honor, or power. So someone's gain was viewed as being at someone else's expense. Now, in today's world, we call this a zero-sum game. It's a view that there's really only one pie, a certain size, and a certain number of slices. So if someone is accumulating more, then it is at someone else's expense. And this helps to explain why Laban and his sons were so mad at Jacob as his flocks and herds increased. They felt like Jacob was stealing from them. But in our society today, we don't have a zero-sum game view of economics because wealth can actually be created. Now, it was okay to be wealthy in the ancient world. Think about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were blessed. They were prosperous. Even David and Solomon would have had a lavish lifestyle as kings. But the wealthy were expected to be very generous with abundant acts of charity to compensate for the inequality. Think about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16. The rich man wasn't condemned for his wealth, but he was condemned for being stingy with it. He wouldn't extend any kind of charity to Lazarus. Another example is Genesis 27, with Jacob stealing of Esau's firstborn blessing by tricking Isaac. Jacob received the great blessing, and when Esau cried out for a blessing, his father gave him what could be considered an odd blessing that wasn't much of a blessing. And that's because there was only one firstborn blessing. Once it was pronounced, it could not be retrieved or duplicated because the blessings were viewed as finite. Esau believed that Jacob's increase came at his expense. Another biblical story that could fit with this principle is Judges 7, when God commanded Gideon to whittle down the number of men who would fight against the Midianites. God did this because he did not want the Israelites to claim the victory as their own. Judges chapter 7 verse 2 reads, "And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me." The Hebrew word translated as vaunt also means to glorify, and it is semantically related to the Hebrew word for honor. So God was saying that he wanted it to be clear who gave Israel the victory so that Israel would not claim glory and honor for itself against God. And this is kind of an interesting idea. In a way, if we think of honor as being a set amount or even on a spectrum, the more that Israel increased its own honor, it simultaneously decreased honor to God. And that makes sense when we think about pride. When we're prideful, we're feeling worthy of honor and glory and bringing it upon ourselves. And the glory amount of glory given to God is diminished. So kind of like a continuum, the more we seek glory and honor, the less God gets. But rather than being full of pride and wanting glory and honor for ourselves, it should be given, all the glory and honor should be given toward God. Another aspect of an honor society was called challenge and riposte, or challenge and response. A person could challenge another person's honor. In fact, they could increase their own honor by challenging someone else's honor if the challenged person did not respond appropriately or took too long to respond. And as I mentioned previously, a challenge to one's honor could be countered verbally or with violence. So the story of Nabal is a good example. David's men requested permission to enjoy some of Nabal's food. But Nabal insulted them by questioning, "Who is David and who's the son of Jesse?" Well, that was a challenge to David's honor. David planned to respond to the insult with violence, but Nabal's wife Abigail wisely intervened. Even the giving of gifts, where there was some expectation of reciprocity, could be considered a challenge to someone. In that case, the person who received the gift had to respond with an even greater gift or suffer disgrace. Now, it's possible that the story of Jacob and Esau's reunion fits this model, and if so, then it provides another angle to view the scenario. When Jacob learned that Esau had 400 men with him, Jacob sent gifts ahead of his family to Esau. Now, we usually think of this as his way of trying to appease his brother in case his brother was still intent on killing him over the birthright and the blessing. And I think that is a very obvious and understandable interpretation. But is it possible that Esau politely refused the gifts because he knew that accepting the gifts would make him beholden to his brother, and then he would have to reciprocate in some way or suffer shame? So let's read Genesis chapter 33, verses 8 through 11. "And he said, 'What meanest thou by all this drove which I met?' And he said, 'These are to find grace in the sight of my Lord.' And Esau said, 'I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself.' And Jacob said, 'Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough.' And he urged him, and he took it." Now notice there's some back and forth going on, but Esau didn't accept the gifts until Jacob called it a blessing. Now this could allude back to the blessing that Jacob had taken. So in a sense, Jacob's gifts could be viewed as an attempt to give back part of the blessing that he had deceptively taken. In which case then, the gifts aren't really a gift, but a form of repayment. And as a form of repayment, no further reciprocity would be involved. So then Esau accepted the gifts. Now, there's no way to 100% determine that the idea of reciprocity is what made the difference in Esau accepting the gifts, but it definitely gives a different nuance to the story. Another example of challenge and riposte, or challenge and response, is a well-known proverb. Two verses are juxtaposed and apparently say the opposite. Proverbs 26 verse 4 says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him." But then the very next verse seems to contradict it. "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit." There are a lot of explanations proposed to explain the apparent contradiction. The most common one I've heard of is that it just depends on the context. Either proverb can be right depending on the situation, and you need wisdom to discern which one is the right course of action. And I think that's a great explanation. But there may also be another one. From an honor culture perspective, these verses could involve a situation of challenge and riposte. The main concern is in how the one being challenged gauges whether he can ignore the challenge and still maintain his honor. And this depends on the status of the two people involved, the challenger and the one being challenged. If the challenger was of a lower status than the one being challenged, then the one being challenged could probably ignore it with no negative effects. Also, if the challenger was of a higher status than the one being challenged, then not reciprocating would be the safest route and would probably incur no loss of face, since the one being challenged was essentially under the authority of the challenger and could do nothing about it. However, if the two people were of the same social status, then the person being challenged must respond in some way to preserve their honor. So verse 4 is possibly a situation in which someone is being challenged by a fool of lesser status, and to even bother to respond would, in a sense, be to give honor to the foolish person who doesn't deserve it. However, verse 5 could apply in situations where the honor of the person being challenged is sufficient, that some kind of response is necessary. It could be that wisdom is at stake, and to ignore the fool would be to admit that folly prevails. So viewed through the lens of honor and shame, ultimately, how one responds to a fool could depend on gauging the effects of shame. As a general rule, it was better to ignore the fool because to engage him further would be to elicit an insult and challenge. However, as verse 5 indicates, there were times when the appropriate response would be to defend one's honor and turn the table, or else experience loss of face. Another special type of significant feature among honor cultures was the patron-client relationship. This occurred outside of familial relations. A patron would extend favor and grace to clients, and the clients would extend honor to their patron. Now, in a sense, the Israelites could have viewed God as their super patron because he took care of them and blessed them. And in return for his provision and protection, they were expected to praise and honor him and be loyal to him. God rewarded those who were loyal and obedient, but those who were disloyal or who were foolish or brought shame to God's name would lose his protection and possibly even receive punishment. Israel's covenant relationship with God meant that obedience brought national honor and honor to God's name, while disobedience led to shame and exile. God's name and reputation were tied to Israel's actions, reinforcing the collective nature of honor. As the examples that we've covered today show, understanding Israel as an honor and shame society helps shed some new light on some biblical narratives. Honor was one of the virtues that the Israelites desired the most. But in Jesus, there was a reversal of the honor and shame. His crucifixion was the ultimate shameful death in the eyes of the Romans and the Jews. But in God's plan, his shameful death became the source of true honor and glory. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul writes about Jesus, saying, "He but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." In contrast to the honor and shame norms of the ancient culture, Jesus willingly took humiliation upon himself as a lowly servant. And then, contrary to the typical honor and shame cultural expectation, he was highly exalted and his name elevated above every other name. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.